This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont Edition turned 7 years old on Wednesday, and I heard from one longtime listener who expressed surprise that we haven't run out of things to talk about. In fact, we don't think we'll ever run out of things to talk about. And one topic we have never covered on the show before with any kind of serious treatment is grammar and how we use language. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we have heard from oh so many of you sharing your grammar pet peeves that we're going to give over the full hour to this topic. Most of us profess good skills when it comes to language, and in my job, it's an imperative, which is why I cringe every time I hear a misplaced modifier or a scrambling of tenses come out of my mouth on live radio. It's particularly embarrassing because I can be a little obnoxious when it comes to correcting others for their grammatical errors. Bring and take, less and fewer, lie and lay, they all get my goat. But I was chastened a while ago when I came across a screed from British actor and comedian Stephen Fry. He's a lover of language and well-known in the UK as a veritable genius. But he's concerned that some people too loudly protest when they stumble upon improper usage. Here's just a little bit of his rant.
When asked to join in a let's persuade this supermarket chain to get rid of their five items or less sign, I never join in. Yes, I am aware of the technical distinction between less and fewer, and between uninterested and disinterested, and infer and imply and all the rest of them, but none of these are of importance to me. None of these are of importance, I said there. You'll notice the old pedantic me would have insisted on none of them is of importance. But I'm glad to say I've outgrown that silly approach to language.
Silly approach to language? I can practically feel the protests coming back at me through the radio waves from some of you. But I'm guessing that others are still scratching your heads thinking, none of them is of importance? What the heck is he even talking about? So let's get right to it. Let's talk grammar and usage today, and you can tell us what grammatical questions embarrass or confuse you. This is a judgment-free zone. Well, sort of. When it comes to asking a question, absolutely. Ask away, judgment-free. But we are also hearing from a lot of you who are judging people and sharing your quote-unquote favorite grammatical mistakes. So ask a question or share yours at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition. Or call and tell us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And I am thrilled to be joined by two English teachers today. Susan Marie Harrington is a professor of English and director of writing in the disciplines at the University of Vermont. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Annie Landenberger is an English teacher at Leland and Gray Union High School. Hello, Annie. Nice to talk with you.
Likewise. Nice to talk with you both.
So, Annie, let's get one thing straight right off the bat. We're actually kind of taking a broad definition of grammar here. So we're actually looking at punctuation, we're looking at usage, we're looking at grammar, all sort of wrapped in together. You use an acronym with your students called GUM, Grammar, Usage, and Mechanics. Can you differentiate for us before we move on?
Grammar and mechanics are what we use when we're constructing a sentence out of words, out of phrases and clauses, out of punctuation marks. Usage is when we look at the actual use of different words. For instance, on your website was the question of further versus farther, and then the lie-lay issue, or usage of a particular word when we say, I'm not really sure that's the word that you want for that expression.
So, like our title for the show today, Grammar, Whom Cares? What, that's wrong?
Use the M test.
Yeah, what's the M test? Give us the M test.
Well, the M test is if you can answer with him, then you use whom. Give the book to him. To whom should I give the book? So the M on whom matches the M on him.
So grammar, him cares, doesn't work. Grammar, me cares.
Well, who cares about grammar? I do. So right. That's a subjective case. And of course, who is subjective? Does grammar matter to me? That's objective case. To whom does grammar matter? Okay, so that's your, you know, then you need to use the objective.
Susan Marie Harrington, grammar matters to you as well, I imagine.
Well, grammar matters, language matters. I love language. It's one of the best things about being human is getting to use language in so many different ways.
And you are interacting with college students and instructors in writing in the disciplines. You're actually helping to teach instructors so that there's a uniform use of language or uniform expectations for students. When you're interacting with college students coming in, are you finding they have a good grasp of grammar?
Yes, absolutely, actually. And I'm also finding that as students come into college, they have a lot to learn. College is a new environment, and every time we enter a new environment, we have new things to learn about how communication works, who gets to talk when, what kind of language they expect. And in fact, writing in the disciplines is less about a uniform approach to language than giving faculty and students vocabularies for helping make sense of the very different expectations that they face in different places. If you write in a poetry class the same way you write your chemistry lab reports, you're going to be considered a great failure, yet that another kind of style of communication is enormously successful. And that's what writing in the disciplines really stresses, that in different places we have different language demands and we need to be able to understand them instead of feeling like people have arbitrary expectations.
Annie Landenberger, I'm holding back the floodgates right now with our phone lines just going crazy, but I really want you to share a story with us before we get into all of these different peccadilloes that people have. Because when you're trying to tell your students about why this is important to know, you do get some pushback. And I understand last year you had a particularly tough group.
He told you. Okay. Well, let me just preface this by saying, you know, I hope that we actually talk about the sort of reasons why we still need to be mindful of grammar. What the pedagogy is around that, of course, is changing a lot. But, you know, grammar, language without grammar is sort of like math without theorems or architecture without a structural engineer or, you know, chemistry without a periodic table. But last year I had a group of seniors and, you know, they're dear kids, but boy, they couldn't wait to get out. And I was trying again to explain the importance of modifiers and how we need to place them correctly. And so one boy kept pushing back, I don't get this. How come we didn't learn this earlier? You know, this is stupid. It's a waste of time. And I employed the worst tool a teacher can employ, which was sarcasm. And I put my hands on my hips and I said, we'll call him Joe. Well, Joe, do you intend to speak the English language for the rest of your life? And he said, I guess I have to modify it. He said, heck no, I live in Vermont. What do I need English for?
Well,
so, that got me. We all laughed.
Well, we're hearing from a lot of people who live in Vermont who beg to differ, who have a lot of opinions about language and usage and some of their pet peeves. Let's go right to it. Joe's calling in from Bridport. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like to address one that I think is one of the most egregious slaughterings of the English language done by very intelligent, aware people, such as a friend who was a grad student majoring in English, and that is a whole nother something or other. I looked it up in the dictionary, and I got another mispronunciation, and I'm wondering, is that liable to be accepted as common usage?
Okay, a whole nother. Susan Marie Harrington, what about that? Just a common usage? I mean, a common way of speaking?
Well, I think it certainly is common usage, and clearly it's a usage that annoys some people. But the idea of clipping off unstressed syllables and running words together when we speak quickly is something that's been going on in English for a very long time. It's also the same, a similar process to why we talk about the fridge in the kitchen rather than the refrigerator in the kitchen.
Which probably wouldn't bother many people to hear about the fridge, and yet a whole nother, you know, certainly bothers a certain segment of the population. And similarly, we got a note, let's find it here, from Dorothy, who says, a big pet peeve for me is the word "acrossed" with the T at the end. She says, I'm also irritated by our local newscasters who don't bother to find out the correct pronunciation of local towns. That's another issue. But what so "acrossed," a whole nother. We got one from Richard in Wardsboro who says, the most annoying pet peeve to me is when the letter O is used instead of the number 0, as when our area code is stated as 802 and not the correct 802. Mm-hmm. He says, listen carefully and you'll hear this mistake made daily by professionals from reputable news organizations. Let's make Vermont the first state to stop this mispronunciation. I don't see that one happening. But Professor Harrington, what about this idea of using it? Are you okay with just having these kinds of language usage questions?
Well, really, there's no way to stop language from people use language, and language changes over time. And over the large scale of history, we don't really have a problem with language change. We don't expect us all to still be talking as we did when the Canterbury Tales were written, or we don't read Shakespeare and think, oh, what's wrong with us that we don't sound like we're in A Midsummer Night's Dream? But when language is changing on the short term, that frequently makes people, some people upset about particular changes. And although those same people who might be upset about O for zero are probably themselves speaking in some other way that someone else would say, how could they say that? And so I think the issue of the use of O for zero is a lost cause. It's simply a synonym for the number. It's another way to express that concept. And of course, if you don't like it, don't do it. And if you run a radio station and you want all your newscasters to say zero rather than O, you can make a style rule for your organization that says, this is how we're going to do it because I want to represent, you know, this is how I want us to communicate and how to represent that. But in the grand scheme of the world and people using language, we can't really stop people from doing that.
Annie Landenberger, do you agree?
Yeah, there's a big difference between spoken and written language. I doubt that that fellow would write across in a letter to a business, for instance. We speak in an entirely different way. It's like code switching between different dialects, for instance. And we have to accept that very often when we speak, we're going to be interrupted. We don't finish our sentences. We start another thought halfway through. And that's the brilliance of the spoken word. I direct theater, too, and I love great dialogue. But that's different than writing prose or poetry, where we just have to be more thoughtful. And it's something like across smacks to me more like an idiom or a regionalism, which is, those are kind of cool. You know, the more we lose those, the more we lose the uniqueness of different regions' manner of speech. But, you know, in terms of the written word, yes, language is changing. But I always say to my kids, you know, you have to learn Rembrandt before you can be Rauschenberg, or you have to learn Beethoven before you can be Stravinsky. Before we can go and break all the rules, I think that it's incumbent on us to expose students to the rules, students of any age. I mean, I'm always learning. I make no claims of knowing at all, believe me. But so I think that as language changes, too, we have to be thoughtful about it. For instance, you know, a text that is just, are you okay, reminds me of a great William Steig book called CDB, and the entire book is just letters communicating phrases and sentences. But if we go there, then we are sort of getting into this chaotic maelstrom of what the heck does he mean? I mean, I've gotten some emails, and I just have to write back and say, huh? I do that on papers, too, sometimes.
But are the two of you as loosey-goosey about, say, the word literally, which right now in Merriam-Webster, Macmillan Dictionary, on Google definitions, and in the Cambridge Dictionary, all of those sources now list a secondary definition of literally, which is figuratively, as in, I literally died when I learned that that's a new definition. Mm. Obviously, I didn't literally die, but that is now an accepted definition of the word and meaning of literally. Are you okay with that?
Me?
Either one of you.
No. Absolutely.
All right, so Annie Landenberger is not okay. Susan Marie Harrington, why are you okay with that?
Well, I think because it's so cool that a word has developed a meaning that's completely the opposite of its original meaning. And I think it's a fabulous example of a language change in progress that's been brought about by young people. It's a change I first noticed in my daughter and all of her friends. And I thought it was really funny. And the first time I heard Sophia say it, and then after that, I started listening to it spread. And I even use it myself in that sense sometime. And it's really not up to me to accept it or not. Mm-hmm. It's a word and it's being used, and I understand people when they use it. And I just think it's terrific.
We should also say it's shortened the number of syllables in the word. You shouldn't really say "I literally." It's, if you're saying it in that way, you should probably be saying "I literally." But Annie, you're not okay with it.
Well, teaching, you know, the figures of speech to kids in 10th and 12th grade English, you know, connotation and denotation. Okay. Denotation is what a word literally means in context. Connotation is what a word figuratively means, metaphorically means in another way in that context. So, you know, it's fine as this sort of cool, kind of cool yo-like colloquialism, but, you know, I still need to stress to my students the difference between connotation and denotation, and accuracy in writing comes into play then too. So many fields demand accuracy in communication, and if we get too slippery, I think we're doing a disservice.
We have so many people sharing with us their thoughts on grammar. Martha in Brunswick, Maine says, the lay and lie thing really bothers me. It seems like I hear them used incorrectly all the time. Suzanne says, I teach remedial English at the community college level. It's so frustrating to try to help my students understand correct pronoun use, subject-verb agreement, parallelism, and other correct grammar when all around them is bad modeling. I can count on finding real-life examples of mistakes of whatever I'm planning on teaching in our local paper or on the morning of class. I don't care if they know the names of all these things, just as long as they understand what sounds right, Suzanne says. Cynthia in Putney noted that her pet peeve is it's different from, not different than. She hears people saying it's different than, and she wants to note that that is not correct. And Charlotte in Essex Junction says, look, I'm almost ready to give up the fight, but when numbers are spoken, the word and represents a decimal point. This is 2014, not 2014. A person might live to be 101 years old, but it shouldn't be said aloud as 101. They weren't 20 and 1 80 years ago. And let's go to Steve calling in from Craftsbury. Hi, Steve.
Hello there, Jane.
Hi,
Jane. I'm a self-appointed chair of the Committee to Eliminate Redundancies, and I want to mention one that just causes my hair to fall out. And I need to remedy that. It is the use of the word advocate, or at least A-D-V-O-C-A-T-E, and the redundancy is, and it's common among us professionals, I advocate for this or that, as opposed to I am an advocate for.
Mm.
The problem word usage is advocate for, using it as a verb. That's it. I'll take you off the air here.
Steve, yeah, I appreciate that. Advocate for versus being an advocate for. Susan Marie Harrington, for people who may be still scratching their heads, can you clarify what Steve is talking about there?
Well, to advocate for something is advocate as a verb, but advocate also is a noun form of expressing a similar concept, someone who is
and
urging.
Yeah.
So you can. I have to say I wouldn't have myself flagged a problem with us either of those sentences that the caller mentioned. But again, it's a great example of something that might sound fine to someone, doesn't sound fine to someone else. Both of those usages seem fairly standard to me. But again, if you get to be in charge of how people want to communicate in a certain setting, then I think it's great to make those expectations clear.
And is Steve technically right that you should say, I advocate the truth rather than I advocate for the truth?
You know, I would have to go look that up. And I know where I would. I would look in my Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage.
Yeah, you know, I have a couple style books with me, but I'm not sure you want me to take the time to look it up. Certainly to say I will counsel you or I'm a counselor for you is fine. Advocate or I am your advocate are both fine. But in terms of advocate for or advocate, I would advocate a change in the schedule. You know what? We'll both look it up, Susan.
Yes.
We are talking grammar today. You can share with us all the grammatical mistakes you hear all the time that make you grind your teeth. Or you can ask a question of our guests if there's something that's got you stumped or some usage that you find yourself just not sure of what's correct to do. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts at vpr.net. You know, some Americans still remember their grammar lessons from Saturday morning cartoons and Schoolhouse Rock. Taking us into the break, here's Conjunction Junction.
Conjunction Junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction Junction, how's that function?
I got three favorite cars that get most of my job done.
Conjunction Junction, what's their function?
I got and, but, and, or. They'll get you pretty far.
This is Vermont Edition, and that's one of Weird Al's latest parodies. In this one, he takes on bad grammar.
Show the world you're no clown.
Say you got an IT, followed by apostrophe.
All right, we're with Weird Al. We're talking about language and grammar on the program today with UVM English professor Susan Marie Harrington and Lila Negre Union High School English teacher Annie Landenberger. And we're also going to get into more philosophical questions as we have been grappling already with some of these about how we use language and what the point of being a stickler is if we acknowledge that language is a living and changing thing that evolves with the people who use it. So maybe text speak is okay. And maybe, I can't say I agree, but maybe the fact that literally is now defined as figuratively in the dictionary is just a sign of the fluidity of this thing we call language. Listeners, you can share your opinion with us. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And boy, I have never been happier that we don't have, well, I guess 800, but we don't have a zero that I have to say as an O or a zero after hearing one of our listeners' pet peeves. Let's go to Nancy calling in from Randolph. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Jane, we were talking about making our message sort of paring down the language.
Mm-hmm.
What I find that we've added to it very often, and for instance, ofa, O-F-A, it's not that big of an idea or that big enough of a problem.
Mm.
Why do we add that? Also, because some of us are picky about language, people are so afraid to use me. She invited my wife and I,
mm-hmm.
for instance. And I hear that all the time, and sort of from people that it sort of surprises me. They use mm-hmm. I because they're afraid to use me.
Yeah, Nancy, I hear that too, and I hear a lot of people saying, you can give that paper to Nancy or myself instead of me. So people, that fear of using the word me. Annie Landenberger, can you address that? Because that certainly is pervasive.
Oh, you have me hopping now. So first of all, let me just say that I consulted a great book, Paul Bryan's Common Errors of English Usage, and the gentleman from my neighboring Wardsboro is correct. It should be advocate.
Mm.
I want to advocate higher salaries for teachers or whatever.
Oh, how interesting. Okay.
Okay. So the problem is the people, again, who don't know the structure of their language hear I and think, well, that's the more formal, polite, correct way to say something, not realizing, again, that one is subjective case and the other is objective. And if you have a preposition, you always have the objective case after the preposition. Please give it to me. And I, you know, you try to say this to students and they look at you like you're a Martian, because what is objective? Subjective. We are there in the classroom, really trying to remind kids of that. So that does drive me crazy. And if it's a student, I will playfully correct my student if it's a peer. I don't do that so much unless they want me to. But and then in terms of the myself, again, people think, well, this reflexive pronoun must be make me sound more important and more knowledgeable. I hear that all the time. Please fill out the form and return it to Barbara or myself. No, to me. Myself is a whole different use. It's reflecting in on yourself.
And I mean, typically, is it okay, Susan Marie Harrington, to take out all of the other people that you're referring to in that sentence and try it out in your head and see what sounds right? Because if it sounds right to say me, if you're the only one in that sentence, that may help. I mean, there's some tricks here. You don't necessarily even need to know whether you're being reflexive or not.
Exactly.
But if you say
yes,
me,
that,
and
that
it
is
fits.
In fact the trick I recommend when people are trying to decide which pronoun to use.
So just say, take out my wife and me, and just say me. And if it sounds right, then it's good.
Yes.
Okay,
because when we're only talking about one pronoun, people usually don't use the wrong one.
Let's go to Nick in Richmond. Oh, Annie, I'll give you a chance in one second. Nick.
Although I still hear me and him are going down to the store.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So you take out him or you take out me, and both of them are wrong.
That's
but
true.
But I totally agree with the take out the other people.
Because no one would say me are going to the store or
right,
him
unless
are
you're
going
a caveman.
To the store. So if you take out one, you would.
Me go store.
All right, let's hear from Nick calling in from Richmond. Hey, Nick.
Okay, hello. Thanks for taking the call. This is always a Thanksgiving dinner debate, and it's the difference between take and bring. My understanding is you take something to someone else, and something is brought to you. So I want to confirm that. And then the second question is, what if you're a third party? Do you ask somebody to take a present to Bill, or are you asking someone to bring the present to Bill?
Are you with Bill?
No.
Okay, so you are somewhere, Bill is somewhere else, and the third person is somewhere else altogether, and how do you get that present to Bill? All right, let's start with that, Susan Marie.
Well, I have to say, yes, I can see the distinction. I am taking the, I am taking the present with me to the party, but I think I could also hear myself saying I am bringing it with me. I think I would use... probably with, I'm bringing with me, I'm bringing salad with me to the picnic or something.
Even though you are not yet at the picnic.
Even though I am at not yet. I think I might use, although I can also see the distinction that the caller is making. And so certainly you wouldn't use take to indicate someone else is giving you something.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's a good thing that the phone lines are full right now,
yes.
Because this is one we hear a lot about. And I imagine we are going to get about 30 people who want to call in and either correct you or agree with you here.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is that many English words have multiple senses. And so it is true that there's a sense of bring that does mean something being delivered mm-hmm. to me, but I think there is clearly another sense of bring that means something is accompanying me
mm-hmm.
And it is in my possession as I am moving mm-hmm. somewhere.
On this one, Bethany says, you bring something to you, you take something away. Could you bring me that pie versus I am going to take a casserole to the potluck? That's how she defines mm-hmm. it. But we did get a note from Jessica in Burlington who says, when I was growing up, my mother constantly reprimanded me for misusing bring and take. She explained the difference many times, but honestly, I still don't get it. So Annie Landenberger, she says, can you please tell me when I should take my lunch to work and when I should bring it? So she wants to know, how is the actual correct proper usage?
I just agree with Susan on this. If I'm going to work and I pick my lunch up off the table, I'm bringing it with me. If my son is going the same direction and I won't have time to get my lunch, I'll say, would you take my lunch to the office, please? But I don't really see that one as being that difficult, but I guess that it is. And now I'm learning something. But take is take this to Joe or take this present to Nick, because I think he's absolutely right in his distinction, or to Susan. But and then if I'm going to bring, or would you please bring me, the dictionary, then it's somebody doing, and I'm the receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy, I had the hardest time growing up remembering, you know. Anyway, no, I won't go there.
Well, I had the hardest time growing up because I had four parents, all of whom have taught English. And so we were, my brother and I were always in trouble for misusing things. And now I thank them because it was right when I was growing up that the word like as just a filler became common usage. And we were not allowed to use like in that manner. And I'm very glad now that I don't have that habit. Let's go to, let's see, Bill, who's calling in from Johnson. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Good morning. So I say something nice about all this change in our language. I mean, there's 200 plus different parts of speech in the Bible, and we're still using some of them today, and some of them were created during that era. So some stick around. William Shakespeare may have created some jargon out of thin air, and you know, jingos that he just made up himself that have entered the lexicon. So this change thing, you know, it's all good.
So you're on board with that, Bill, as language changes, language evolves.
Well, it changes, but my concern is that the present state of affairs with Facebook and Twitter and tweet and this and that and the other thing is towards brevity, abbreviation, and conciseness to the point of a lack of clarity. And I'm wondering if your guests have seen any research or have experienced in a classroom that it is physically changing our brains in terms of our attention spans.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah. Annie, I hear you.
Yeah, 100%. It's what I call, in some cases, electronics addiction. And we, as a school, are grappling with this, as is every school in the state or nation, probably, about the use of cell phones and computer equipment, et cetera. No doubt that the digital age has brought us invaluable research tools and incredible mechanisms for communication. On the other hand, when not used responsibly and thoughtfully, what we're seeing is a truncation of communication. So what used to be a well-developed, I hate to sound like such an old nerd, but what used to be a well-developed few paragraphs in a letter home is now a monosyllabic cluster of stuff that some people understand, and I rarely do. That if we can't sustain the thought to develop a sentence into a paragraph, into an essay, then we're losing a great part of our kind of brain power, I believe. We're not thinking deeply. Facebook, I can only do it like once every 6.5 weeks because it drives me crazy. I don't want to hear what somebody had for breakfast, you know, in sort of monosyllables. And I know that's a terribly unpopular position, but we have to encourage kids to develop ideas. And to develop ideas, they have to use words.
Susan Marie Harrington, pick up on that, because we've talked a little bit about how language changes and how, as long as we understand one another, isn't that the main point? And that there are these ways that you can tweak language, the literally, figuratively thing, that can be interesting, can be sort of brought into the way people speak. But we have to understand one another. So if some of the population is understanding text speak and some isn't, are we in trouble?
Well, but we all have the capability to learn new language forms, and I think that goes both ways. I think the use of language on social media is often enormously creative. Students are immersed in writing all the time. I think this is really exciting. Students write a lot. Now, is it okay to use text speak in your formal report to your boss? Probably not, unless you're writing a formal report about text speak, perhaps. But you can learn to adjust your language. I do believe, as Annie does, that it's a great thing to be able to write essays, to be able to elaborate our thoughts, and to know when and how to expand our thinking and our, you know, to communicate at greater length and to sustain an argument and to be able to do that articulately and appropriately. Sometimes it's also really great to have a little soundbite. Your producer was saying, you know, at the end of the show, there's a, you know, 30-second warning, and that's the time to be brief. It's a great time to maybe have 140 character closing thought. But that's not the thing to say when there's a moment in the show for a longer thing. So I think the use of social media just gets people writing, and that's a good thing. And it gives them a kind of experience that Annie or I could build on and engage with and contrast with to say, you can do that, you can do these other things as well. So I don't see it as a contest mm-hmm. that one is bad and we have to get them to do something good instead.
Although I guess the question too is, are we all learning enough skills so that we can choose when to use the different kinds of language? You know, if I sent to Professor Harrington an email that was full of abbreviations and text speak and a misuse of words that are commonly used but maybe in the vernacular have a different meaning, that might impact me. Ha ha. There, I just verbed that. Sorry. That might have an impact on my career in a way that is detrimental. Mm-hmm. So I need to know when to use proper language and when I can be a little bit more casual. And I guess the question is, are young people today learning all of those
Absolutely.
Skills?
We are language learning people. We learn language naturally. And if you sent me that kind of email that you described and you are in the first year seminar that I'm going to be teaching this fall, I would probably use the occasion to mentor you about what's a great way to email a professor. And in fact, that's one of the little, I have a 10-minute useful thing in class every week. And one of the useful moments I do is to be very explicit to students. How do you email a professor in a way that's going to attract positive attention, because they are used to, in high school, seeing all of their teachers all the time, maybe even every day, and they know, they just go up and talk. They don't know yet how to send an email. If you wrote like that in an email as a job application, I'd probably just toss it off into right. the circular file. And, you know, so I think the important thing is to provide opportunities for all of us to learn what we need to learn as we move into new settings. And that's what I think is fun about being an English teacher. I get to help people learn how to communicate.
We're talking about grammar today. We're expanding this discussion to talk about how we use language. And so many of you are chiming in. It's really great. Scott emailed to say data are plural. Jennifer in South Burlington says, one of my biggest bugaboos is preventative. Ah, it's preventive. And here's my justification, she says. We say representation, so it's representative, but we don't say preventation. It's prevention with no extra ta, so the correct word is preventive. Peter in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania says, the woman that walked across the street instead of who. That's his pet peeve. You should be saying the woman who walked across the street. Peter says, it's become so universal that even the New York Times refers to people as that. Also, he says, verbification is out of hand. So he probably cringed when I said impact as a verb. Peter says, as Calvin told Hobbes, verbing weirds language. Jessica in Chicago says, I try to keep the irritation on the inside because I know my grandmother rolls over in her grave every time I end a sentence with a preposition, but to do otherwise ends up sounding stiff and overly formal, like Diane on Cheers. There is some crap up with which I will not put. On the other hand, Mary says, Mrs. Bedell, Stowe English teacher extraordinaire, would be mortified. She writes to us for Vermont Edition saying, your promotion for today's show included the phrase, have a leg to stand on, which should have been have a leg on which to stand. Mm. We're going to keep talking about grammar coming up here on Vermont Edition. You can share your thoughts by going to the Vermont Edition Facebook page.
Well, every person you can know and every place that you can go and anything that you can show, you know they're nouns. A noun's a special kind of word. It's any name you ever heard. I find it quite interesting. A noun's a person, place, or thing.
You're listening to Vermont Edition. That's a little more Schoolhouse Rock there as we finish up our conversation about grammar with Susan Marie Harrington, UVM professor of English, and Annie Landenberger, English teacher at Leland and Gray Union High School. So many of you chiming in on your pet peeves about how people use language. Teresa says, misplaced apostrophes and the improper use of less for fewer are grammar gaffes that make me cringe. Neil says, my pet peeve is when people write used to instead of used to, U-S-E-D. Some of these are really difficult to do on the radio. Neil also says, or could care less, which actually implies that you do care just a little bit. When someone says, I could care less, meaning they couldn't care less. Cheryl from White River Junction says, height, pronounced height, is her pet peeve. She says, I have heard that on NPR. I have far too many employees who think that I weren't is proper grammar. When they're new, I hold my tongue as long as I can, but it's like nails on a chalkboard. Kathy in Essex Junction says, I cringe when I see towards and forwards, when toward and forward are the way to go. And Rich in Thetford Center says, what drives me crazy is when people butt one is upon another is. There are times when an is can directly follow an is, but mostly there aren't. Boy, people are getting very specific here. Let's go to Jeffrey in Fairfield. Hi, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Hi. Really appreciate the forum today. Actually, a perfect time to talk about, I wanted to talk about my first peeve was the sort of hypercorrective, but I suspect mostly an accretion, anhistoric. And I suppose the leftover aspirant British H is probably the real culprit. But I'm kind of curious as to why that's affixed itself so well in the minds of many hypercorrectors. It seems like that's a real favorite of people that pride themselves on using correct language, which is not wrong, but it seems like it's that bridge too far by being, you must keep yourself additionally correct if you go to those great lengths. And in general, for example, in that perfect before the last break, the ending a sentence with a preposition, which is one of the most popular fake or phony rules that people think are still rules. So I guess my question was just in hypercorrection in general and what you folks think of it.
Yeah, thanks for the comment, Jeffrey. Hypercorrection, certainly we talked about that a little bit with people who say myself when they should be saying me because they want it to sound correct. Susan Marie, what about that idea that, you know, people do get so alarmed now that they overcorrect and in some cases get it wrong?
Yeah, well, actually, there's two different things going on in the examples from the caller, because stand on isn't really a preposition at the end of the sentence. Stand on is a phrasal verb, so the verb there is stand on. And there's a number of examples.
So that's okay.
That.
We got it okay.
I think that's fine. Of course, one could say a leg on which to stand, but that sounds so stuffy. Like, no one would say that. But one could. I mean, that would also work, right? But stand on works as a phrasal verb. The variation in pronunciation with anhistoric and ahistoric, I think you'd probably hear both out in the wild. But anhistoric does have that formal sound to it. And actually, I don't even know if that's a hypercorrection or not, or just a pronunciation variant.
You know, one that I want to just squeeze in here because it's something that we have constant arguments about in the newsroom is the Oxford comma. And of course, this is the last comma in a list of things before the and. So I have, everybody knows what I mean. You have a list of things and before and, I love the Oxford comma. Put the comma there before you say and for clarity's sake. But apparently, according to proper usage, it's gone. No more Oxford comma. Annie?
It really depends on the setting. In journalism, you take off any extraneous characters because in the old days when advertising was still really popular, print ads, every time you used an excessive character, you were taking away from ad space, from column inch space. I tell kids either way. We don't have enough time for me to tell you about my eighth grade English teacher and that, but I actually don't use it. Unless it's really an issue of clarity. And for my kids, I'll take it either way.
Oh, so I'm not going to get any support here from Annie Landenberger.
Well, although I do use the comma myself because I clearly remember Mrs. O'Brien teaching me that in third grade.
Well, and so here we go. You know what you're taught and the people who teach you about language, it sticks with you. Susan Marie, before we go, just final thoughts here.
I would say on many of these matters, editors matter. Style guides matter. And so pay attention to the person who has power in when you're producing documents, producing texts, making a speech. Pay attention to who's got the power and let that matter. But in generally, I would advise listeners to enjoy the wonderful thing that is our language that we share and get to use. It's a lot of fun, so enjoy the variation.
Danny, you've got a final thought?
Yes, and Leland and Gray were doing an awful lot to improve our use of language, our writing, because that's really a key to success in the future. And one thing we're trying to do is push ahead with the Common Core, which I actually like. I understand some don't. But the Common Core requires that we start in grade one really, really, really teaching the labels of the building blocks of our language. And when that comes to fruition, I think that some of these dialogues about usage and sort of defenses of, you know, these more colloquial things in preference over correctness will sort of disappear once we can really ensure that kids are at least getting the ground rules, and then they can break them.
All right. That's a great comment. Get the ground rules, then you can break in. We're talking about grammar. We're talking about language and the way this all evolves. So fascinating. So many of you contributing. Please carry on online. Go to our Facebook page to share your pet peeves or to maybe help somebody who has a question. We'll have to do this again. Susan Marie Harrington, UVM Professor of English, and Annie Landenberger, English teacher at Leland and Gray Union High School. Thank you both so much.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure.
That will do it for today. Monday on the program is the first of two primary debates. There are three Republican candidates vying for the chance to unseat Democrat Peter Welch in the U.S. Congress. We're going to hear from all of them, let them ask questions of one another, and if you have a question for them, send it to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us Monday at noon. Later in the week, we'll hear from the Republican candidates for governor. Before we go today, we want to say goodbye to Catherine Hayes, our college intern. Catherine returns to Middlebury College for her senior year. Catherine, thank you for all your help and great work. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.